My name's Sandra and I'm an addict. And I feel afraid. And it's kind of weird to hear my Scottish accent over a microphone. And I was looking at the microphone earlier on and I was saying to myself, oh shit, you know, I think I better sing a song. And which was something that was very, very traditional in my family, particularly when they got drunk. Everybody was asked to get up and sing a song, and most of the songs that were sung were always about, you know, kind of lost love and deprivation and orphans and, you know, and stuff like that. And as a child, I was also asked to get up and sing with my hairbrush in front of the family. And so I was able at that age to accumulate quite a lot of shame. Anyway. And I think, you know, it's important just to kind of tell you a bit about my background, particularly the family that I grew up in, because I know that for me today, not only am I recovering from the disease of addiction, I'm also recovering from all that stuff that happened back then, and it's very, very important for me to acknowledge that. I guess one of the reasons why I used was to kind of, you know, numb that stuff out. Anyway, as you can probably guess, I'm from Glasgow. I'm not Welsh or Irish or anything else. I'm a Glaswegian through and through. And I've just recently been in Glasgow, and what happens to me when I go up there is that I start to swear a lot because it's kind of it's part of the culture, so that might happen tonight. Please don't be offended. Anyway, I grew up in a very, very violent family where it was kind of natural and very, very common for just to kind of witness quite a lot of blood being splattered over the walls. Hammers would come out at the weekend. People would have their noses bitten off. So if you can imagine how that would leave a child feeling, then I guess the first feeling that I remember back then was terror. And I kind of learned to do all sorts of stuff when I felt like that, you know. Shoplifting was one of them, to deal with the stuff that was happening indoors. And kind of rocking back and forth sometimes used to kind of soothe me as well. And basically, it was about your nightmare. My father was an alcoholic as well as a rageaholic, and my mother was a raging codependent. So me and my brother didn't have a hope in fucking hell in terms of feeling safe whatsoever. The two feelings that was allowed in my family were... No, I think there was just one. Anger. And so all that kind of stuff was going on. And another thing that I used to do to kind of cover up that stuff would be tell lots of lies, you know, and kind of fantasy became kind of refuge for me as well. And nobody was ever allowed to come back to my house, you know, that wasn't allowed. In fact, when people used to come at the door, my father used to go, shh, you know, and so we were like, fuck, you know, somebody's at the door, what have we done, you know. So some more shame went in there as well. So by the time that I was about, you know, 11, 12, and I was experimenting with drugs and alcohol, it was great, you know, because I didn't have to think about, you know, what I was going to walk into. You know, I used to come home from school and kind of dread putting that key in the door because I never, ever knew what to expect. My mother also went to prison for quite a long time, and so she wasn't around as well when I was about seven, and we kind of got sent to some of the relatives to kind of live there with them, and all sorts of weird and wonderful things happened to me whilst I was there, again accumulating some more shame. So, I mean, I first started using alcohol, and it was, you know, kind of bottles of cider at the weekend, and, you know, the thing was to get completely blitzed out your head and be sick, you know, that was the deal. And if you woke up the next day and couldn't remember what you'd done, then obviously you had a good time, you know. And I'd often kind of wake up, you know, we kind of had like chili sauce and onions and cabbage and kind of the whole kebab thing, you know. And and that went on for quite some time. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, I had the drug of choice, but in the beginning, you know, my drug of choice was anything, really. I'd take anything for acid too. I don't know if anybody in the room will remember, there was a travel sickness pills called Marzine. And if you like to trip at high peak for 15 hours at a time, then that's what you're gonna get. Very, very terrifying, scary experiences. And the kind of crazy thing, you know, I've come to understand it today is that it talks about it in our literature, you know, it talks about insanity, you know, doing the same things and expecting different results. And I kind of do that stuff. And, you know, I take all sorts of kind of LSD and acid, and I would get together in a group at the weekend, and I'd take that stuff, and my heart would start to beat ba-bum, 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 really fast, and I knew that was, you know, I was going down. And, you know, on one occasion, I kind of imagined that I couldn't breathe, and I said to my friends, oh, shit, you know, I can't breathe, and they just started laughing at me, you know. And I'd done it again, and I'd done it again, and I'd done it again. And then I found my drug of choice, and when I found it, it was very, very important for me to get it in as quick as possible. You know, I didn't want to fart about where, I didn't want to sniff it, you know, or I didn't want to swallow it, you know, I wanted to get it in. And I felt that, and I always remember that time, that first hit that I had, that, you know, for the rest of my using, I always chased it, you know, and would try and kind of recapture that experience time and time again, which was very difficult, you know, because as we know, when you use, you build what's called tolerance. And and I did that for many years, and around about the age of 15, my father committed suicide, and you know, was kind of a venomant on me and my mother coming to watch him whilst he committed the act, you know, and which we didn't do, but I found him. And it's kind of one of those video nasties that I've kind of got in my head that I'm going to be left with forever. Awful it was, you know, and I can kind of see, although I started using when I was about 12, when I think about it, when it really took off was around about the age 15, where I just didn't give a fucking shit, you know. I'd like to think that I cared about you, but at the end of the day, I didn't really, you know. It was very manipulative. I'd invite people around my flat only because I knew that I was going to get something out of them, you know. Whilst they were gouging, I'd go in your pockets. I'd take your drugs. I'd fill your methadone bottles up with water and hope for the best. And absolutely deny the fact that I'd kind of taken it at all. And then came the wonderful kind of a cocktail of heroin and temazepam, and had a few weird experiences with that. I don't know about anybody else in the room, but when I used to take that drug, I was invisible, and I'd kind of get into shops. You know, I funded my addiction by shoplifting. I wasn't that good at it, but I thought I was anyway, and I used to think that I was invisible, and I was clatty. If you don't know what clatty means, then it's dirty, you know, smelly. And I'd go shoplifting, you know, and I'd think that I was invisible, and I'd think that nobody could see me, you know what I mean? And I'd be fucking fuming if I got caught. You know, and I'm fucking fuming. And I would deny it, you know, and there I would be standing in front of the judge, you know, and he'd sentence me, and I'd be getting, you know, taken up to the local prison, and I'd be sitting in the big van with the silver bangles on, and I'd be thinking, why is this happening to me? Where the fuck am I going, you know? And And so then, I'd take me through reception, and then I'd still be like, what am I doing here? And then, of course, you know, once you get there, you learn to manipulate and you kind of put on the withdrawal symptoms even more, you know, because you want to see the nurse because you know you got to get something, you know. And so that's how my using was. And I guess, like most people in the room, you know, I kind of left the country. I stayed in the country. I cut my hair, changed partners, had a child, did everything that I possibly could. Gave my drugs to people, particularly my mother. We planned this fucking detox thing, which was a whole load of bollocks. And it was like that. You know, it was like that. And I guess towards the end of my using, my denial was as such that I didn't have a problem with drugs. I didn't have a problem with drugs. I had a police problem. And the police problem that I had was is that I had 4 warrants out for my arrest, and I needed to do something about that, you know. And I kind of thought that, you know, I went to America for a while and kind of put that off. And I went to America and I kind of put down the drugs, and I stayed with my brother, and I became an alcoholic, you know. And I used to go out with him at night time, and I'd be drinking like fucking double, treble brandies, you know, and I'd get pissed, and they'd be like, what's going on with you, you know? And I kind of had all these plans about what, you know, when I returned, when I came back home, then I was going to stop using. But, you know, I'd kind of get to the airport, I'd get on the plane, and I was already converting the dollars into smack, you know. And I think the thing that kind of brought me to my knees was the police problem. And towards the end of my using, I think one of the biggest fears that I had was about being locked up, was about being left with my head. I don't know how anybody else thinks, but that was my worst nightmare, you know. You're just, it's like the clucking's in the post and you know it, you know, and you look at your eyes in the mirror and they're like saucers and you think, fuck, you know. And when you're locked up, there's no, particularly at the weekend and the cop shop, there's no much that you could do. I wasn't one of the addicts who kind of went to the doctors and got lots of pills and stuff like that. My doctor was a fucking tight arse, you know. The most that she ever gave me was 7 fucking Mogadon. And if you've ever taken Mogadon, it's like they're fucking nasty, you know, proper nasty sleeping pills. Anyway, I decided that what I needed to do was I needed to kind of leave Glasgow, because sooner or later, the police were going to catch up with me and I would be sent back to prison. And I wasn't one of the lassies, you know. You get lassies in the jail who are like, you know, it's fucking home from home in the jail for them. And for me, it wasn't home from home. I hated being locked up, you know. They'd open the cell in the morning, I'd kind of come out and I'd have the swagger, you know, the whole thing going on. I'd maybe skip a bit and do, life's great. Oh, is it fuck great, you know. I hated it, you know. And at night time, they would close the door and I would be in tears. I'd be crying for my mother, you know. And I remember one time, oh God, it was terrible. I was locked up and I thought, I mean, has anybody smoked hash when you've been clucking? Okay, paranoia city. So anyway, I'm locked up, I've got the hash, done the joint, smoked it out the windy, paid for the paranoia, and there's nowhere to go in your head when you're locked up, you know, you're in there. And I thought, right, I'll just fucking lie down in the bed. And I was lying there, and the next minute, a wasp started flying around the cell. Fuck. And I'm not going to scream because I've got lots of pride, you know. Oh, Jesus. It was a nightmare. Anyway. Stoned at my head with a wasp locked up. Hate them. I hope the people that are laughing are identifying with me. And no thinking that I'm a pure bam. which is stupid in Glasgow. Anyway. So, okay. I decide that what I need to do is I need to go on somewhere and get some kind of detox. And that was an experience in itself. You know, I phoned this place, and it happened to be in London, and begged them on the phone, you know, for their help. And they wanted to kind of pan me off with some kind of methadone maintenance deal, and that's not what I needed, because my plan of action was that I need to get my ass into detox so that I can stand in front of the judge and tell him that I've been a good girl and that the sentence would be less. And anyway, begging this guy on the phone to get into detox, which I did, and I go in there, and he said to me, you know, what you need to do, Sandra, is that you need to stay clean for 24 hours. I said, no problem. What? I always had good intentions when I was using, you know. I always told my mother that I was only going to the shop and I wouldn't be long and I would be gone for days. Anyway, I couldn't keep clean for the 24 hours, and I ended up somewhere on King's Cross, and I bought this smack, and it was crap, and thank God for that, because the next day my eyes were on the pinned, because, you know, the place that I was going, they kind of come out to the hospital. You might know the place that I'm talking about, and they get you in a dark room and they shine a torch in your eyes. and I passed the test, you know, and... so I get sent to this detox, and I've got, like, a black bag with, like, you know, packing rags in it, you know, and thinking I was something. And I kind of gets in there, and it's a bit like, you know that bit in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and you've got Nurse Ratchet, and she shouts through the microphone, medication. It felt a bit like that. Well, certainly that's all the shit that was going on in my head, you know. And so they come and they take your pills, and off you toodle up the stairs, and you kind of get the kind of the methadone. And I never ever trusted it. I always thought that they were fucking... It wasn't methadone, it was something else, and it wasn't enough, and it wasn't working. And, you know, they were playing tricks in my fucking mind, you know. And very confusing time it was for me, you know. If you remember back to that time when you stopped using, I mean, certainly for myself, I thought that I felt like an alien. I felt like I had like four heads. There was all this stuff happening in my head that, you know, was fucking mind blowing, you know. And at times, you know, I found it really difficult just to do the simplest things like open a door. You know, I knew that in my mind how a door opens, but actually getting my brain to engage, to kind of open the door, was very difficult. And I know that sounds a bit strange, but, you know, I had used for a long time. Anyway, so there I was in the detox, and that was okay. It was a bit weird. And I used to put lots of Ralgex on my knees to somehow heat them up. I was coming towards the end of that detox, and basically what happened was I had a choice. I had some money in my pocket. My plan was Errol's Court, go and score, or what else was on offer? I ended up in Brighton, and I kind of thought to myself that I'll go down there for 3 months, you know, kind of keep away for the jagging. And I'll go back to Glasgow and I'll hand myself in, you know, and the judge will take pity on me. And hopefully I won't go back to prison. So I landed in this place in Brighton, and my first thought was, okay, when I get out here, I'm going to go shoplifting, because they kind of keep you in for 7 days. And I was just mad. I was mad. If you remember back when I told you earlier on that, you know, one of the acceptable feelings in my family was anger, and when I stopped using drugs, I was so fucking angry. In fact, I was raging, you know. I didn't have the anesthetic anymore to kind of shut the shit up, you know, and so I kind of felt totally self-obsessed, de-skilled, couldn't have a conversation with anybody. I was always trying to work out what you wanted from me. It's very, very self-obsessed in the beginning. So I arrived in this gaff, and one of the requirements there was that we had to go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and my intention at the time was, well, you know, I'll go along, see if there's any nice-looking men, was one thought. See if there was any drugs, Narcotics Anonymous. See if there was a party, and to my fucking shock, I ended up in a church hall, and I've been sitting in church halls for 14 years, still having feelings about that. people were drinking tea and coffee, and they were smiling, looking very comfortable, like they were having a really good time, and I just thought, you must be joking. No. I mean, there's some people in the fellowship who think, you know, they arrive in the fellowship and they go, yeah, I'm home. You know, I feel at home here. That wasn't the case for me, you know, and I had all that stuff that people suffer, fade, denial, you know, and selective hearing, and, you know, you hadn't used like me and blah, 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 and all that kind of stuff. And it took a long time for me to kind of feel that, to trust it, basically. I think that that's what it boiled down to at the end of the day. Anyway, what they didn't tell me in the meeting, in that very first meeting, is at the end of the meeting, they go through the key rings, and if you're a newcomer, then you're kind of encouraged to put your hand up, you know, and somebody's nudging me, you know, put your hand up. I put my hand up, and everybody started clapping. Oh, whoa. Oh, God, I got so angry about that, you know. And I thought, right, you bastard, some fucking no coming back here again. Anyway. And, you know, the people that I kind of grew up with in recovery, I mean, thank God for them that they had enough tolerance and patience to put up with me, you know, because I was very, very difficult in early recovery, as, you know, I was very, very angry, you know, and very mistrusting. Anyway, it took me a long time to kind of get this. And basically, I think that, you know, things changed for me. I also went through a treatment centre as well. And you know, for me, that treatment centre was kind of part and parcel of helping me save my life, you know, and helping me start to take some responsibility, and helping me to just start to kind of get a grip on the head and the whole feelings thing, you know. And I had some really good times in treatment. I don't know about anybody else, but it was the first place where I began to have those, you know, them belly laughs, where you're laughing and you're trying to breathe at the same time and you can't, and you don't know if you're going to piss yourself. You know, fucking, it was great, you know. And anyway, where was I? I was in treatment, right, okay. Okay. So it took a long time for me to get this, and basically it was about trust. And I think that, you know, for me, things did start to change when I had kind of got a grip, particularly the second step, you know, coming to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And, you know, I'm not big on God, you know, and I'm big on higher power and, you know, kind of having a sense of, you know, my conscience, which has developed as I've worked the steps. You know, I definitely can sit here today and know right from wrong, you know. And that was kind of a turning point for me, you know, and I began to kind of trust people in the rooms, and I could actually hear what people were saying, and slowly but surely I was able to kind of identify myself and stuff like that, and, you know, kind of the self-obsession lessened. Since then, I mean, my how do I tell you about my life? And I don't know, what have I got left? 20 minutes or something? I can't. I can give you snippets, you know. I kind of tell you everything. What I can say is that it's been a phenomenal journey, very painful at times. I think that what this fellowship has given me, it's given me everything that I've got today. It's given me confidence, respect, stuff that, you know, I had kicked out of me, basically, you know. the steps has kind of helped me work through quite a lot of that shit feedback then, you know, and I continue to work through it, you know. I mean, it's been a long time since my father's suicide, and it's only this year was I able to get my mother and father's wedding photograph. I got it blown up and I got it in a frame and I've got it in my front room, and I can, you know, I can actually sit and look at that today, whereas before, you know, I haven't been able to do that stuff. I've been in long-term relationships and recovery. I'm not in a relationship at the moment, and I think I'm about 4 months down the line. Is that what I said, Ros? Yeah, at the Glasgow Convention. I have to remind myself. and relationships are kind of a tricky area, aren't they? You know, especially for me, you know, because I don't trust. And I remember earlier on when this person told me that he loved me, it broke my heart, and I cried buckets. You know, I couldn't believe that, you know, somebody could actually love me. Without the hidden, no other agenda kind of stuff, you know, that was very, very difficult stuff. And I was in that relationship for a long time, and I learned so much about myself. Everything that I had been taught before, particularly growing up in my family, did come back to haunt me, and, you know, and it will, you know, there's way that stuff for me, my experience has been is that, you know, the best way to kind of heal it is to work through it, you know, and that's been very painful, you know. But what I realised about relationships, and I was sharing this when I was up in Glasgow, is that I used to think that I you know, I can do the intimacy thing and the whole deal, you know, but at the end of the day, it's just recently coming out of a relationship. I don't trust. I still don't trust fully. I don't think I ever will. I'm okay with that. I can commit, but only to a certain level. And I think that, you know, that is as a result of lots of stuff. You know, my father used to sit me down and, you know, look me straight in the face and tell me over and over again that he didn't love me, you know. And when you're small, that kind of stuff kind of takes hold, you know, and it gets right in. And so it's very, very painful. Those are kind of some of the things that I've kind of had to work through, and I still continue to work through it. So I've had to do quite a lot of adjusting, you know. I've been used to kind of, you know, thinking for a family, and I'm trying to kind of let go of that stuff, you know. So things like going out to buy like potatoes and carrots, it's got a whole new meaning, you know. One baked potato and one carrot's enough for me now. And I kind of, sometimes I bounce off the kind of walls of my flat, you know, I get bored and I start to put some music on, I have a dance, I think I'll shave my legs, paint my toes. Get out an exercise video, you know. I do make myself laugh, I really do. I fucking do, seriously. But, you know, I've got a mad head, you know, I will totally admit that, you know. I've been around, you know, a while, and I you know, I did, but there isn't a cure, you know. This is it. I say that with fondness, though, you know, because it's through working the steps. Am I able to sit and talk like this and be all right with it, you know? You know, it's, fourth and the fifth, the sixth and the seventh really helped me out with Sandra and where she was coming from and who she is and where she wants to go, basically. And some of the stuff that I want to keep is particularly my sense of humour, you know. I did think that when I worked the fourth and fifth, I'd kind of come out a big box with a big pink ribbon and have a different personality. It doesn't work like that. Anyway, I mean, some other stuff basically in my recovery is that, you know, I've done the college stuff. I've done the kind of jobs, you know, going round houses and selling stuff and trying to make a bit of a living. I've worked in cafes, making toast, and kind of went to college and done that stuff. And I've got quite a few certificates now, you know, and I've even got letters after my name. I grew up in a council estate in Glasgow, you know, and I'm so proud of myself for that, you know. I did think that I was unteachable, but I'm not. I'm actually quite clever, really. So people tell me, anyway. And I have a wonderful job, which is hard work at times. I manage a 12-step treatment centre in Brighton, and that's fucking fantastic for me. You know, there are lots of people out there who I am not able to make amends to, you know, and so I feel really privileged, you know, to kind of be in a position where I'm able to help newcomers, you know, almost every single day of the week, and that's really, really rewarding. I don't want to stay in that business for a long time. I want to do some other stuff, and I think that I've got the potential to do it. Now, 14 years ago, I would not have been able to sit here and say that. You know, I wouldn't have said anything, you know. More recently, though, I mean, I have a 17-year-old daughter, and I love her dearly. She's my flesh and she's my blood. And I used all the way through my pregnancy. And I don't know how it happened, but she wasn't born withdrawing. I don't know how that happened, but, you know, it happened anyway. And I've kind of, you know, through my recovery, I've kind of done everything that I possibly can to protect her. We've moved to Glasgow. I stay in Brighton. Made sure she went to the right schools, loved her as much as what I possibly could, and, you know, and kind of watched her grow, do the teenage stuff, you know, going to school with an orange face, thinking that it was fine. You know, I've just seen all the changes in her, and I would like to say that I would die for her, and I feel very, very protective of her. And more so recently, a couple of months ago, I mean, Steph's heard this story. Haven't you, Steph? She made a decision that, you know, she wanted to go be somebody from Liverpool. Now, Steph, this isn't about you, all right? It's about one person from Liverpool, okay? I'm sure there's some other people, it's, you know, anyway. So she made a decision that she wanted to go with somebody from Liverpool. Why? She likes the accent. Okay, that makes sense. The accent's okay. Anyway, and so she did. She went out and she got herself a boyfriend, and that was fine. And then one day I was tidying her bedroom, and she's got a shoebox under her bed, and she keeps all wee letters and things in it, you know, and there was $5,000 in there, and I thought, fuck, this guy is definitely not an antique dealer. That's what I wanted to believe, you know, and I mean, this stuff's very painful for me. So anyway, we had the conversation about the $5,000. He's a heroin and crack cocaine drug dealer. It was one thing that I did not want to happen, and it's happened. She's no using heroin. I mean, she likes a drink. I'm cool with that. And apparently he doesn't use the heroin and crack cocaine, but, you know, it's how he makes his money. And Natalie likes money. She likes staying in fancy hotels, and she likes very, very expensive bottles of champagne. She likes Gucci as well. And so anyway, we have the conversation about the $5,000. Obviously, you know, it's like when you're attached to somebody emotionally, anybody tries to kind of intervene, cut the umbilical cord, it's not going to happen. I've tried. And basically, over the last few months, what I've had to work through is powerlessness and helplessness like I've never felt in my whole life. Never felt, well, I felt it before when I was growing up in the violent family. But basically he's battered her on a couple of occasions. She's been pregnant and had a miscarriage, and this all happened within 2 months, you know. And and I'm still recovering from it, you know. I have a home group in Brighton, and it's a fantastic meeting. It's very, very safe, and you know, I'm able to kind of work through that stuff there, you know. And the problem that I have is that my daughter cannot see the abuse. She cannot see it. Very, very painful. And there's nothing that I can do about it, and that's painful too. You know, I've had the kind of scenarios going round in my head about, you know, managing the anger in the way that I know that I used to, but that doesn't work. And kind of containing that amount of anger and rage is very, very difficult as well, you know. I mean, what do you do? What I do is I go for a walk, and what happens is a blackout, and I end up in places, and I don't know how I got there, but I just keep walking, you know. So that's very, very difficult at the moment. And I think, you know, MERS so difficult. I've just recently completed another fourth and fifth step, and I'm in the sixth step as well, you know. So I'm very conscious of my defects of character, and as was my experience the first time around with the sixth step, is that, you know, that I became conscious of the defects of character, and then I had to get willing, and I don't feel willing yet to kind of become entirely ready to let them go, you know. And you know, sometimes I want to kill the boyfriend, you know, really want to kill him. 5 minutes already? Okay. I didn't think I'd be able to talk for 40 minutes, but I can talk the hind legs off a donkey. Anyway, moving away from the pain. I think I have said, you know, I've tried many, many ways to kind of, you know, stop using. I've been on some mad, paranoid journeys with drugs, and repeated it time and time again. And I think what I want to say is the only thing that's ever worked for me is, you know, coming to the church halls, you know, the stuff that I kind of loathed in the beginning, drinking the tea and coffee and sharing my experience, you know. It's a weird phenomenon, isn't it, that we all kind of get together. We share what's going on for us, and somehow, hook or by crook, you know, it might not shift at that moment, but we kind of get out of this thing that's between my ears called my brain, that gets me in trouble and comes up with all kind of a strange things, you know, and I have to keep sharing that stuff. And it helps, you know. I have a sponsor, I work the steps, and I think that I'll continue to do that, you know. I don't know anybody who in this fellowship yet who's died of a feeling or having feelings, but I do know a lot of people who've mismanaged them and used drugs to kind of cope with that stuff and have died as a result, you know. I know I've kind of, you know, I've had lots of loss and I've been able to survive it. And in actual fact, although I've got the shit going on with my daughter, my life's fucking great. It really, really is. It's great. You know, I've had friendships and closeness and laughter and intimacy with people that, you know, I tried to get some of that stuff when I used drugs, you know. And I never ever, I just got further and further away from it, you know. There's a lot of people in the fellowship in Brighton I can call my friend, you know. I never had friends before, I had associates. Anyway, I think I'll leave it there. Thanks for listening.